Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and this is the Zero Point Radio Show through BBS Radio. Oh my God, what a terrible situation we all face in North America. This terrible situation we're all facing. The pilots is flying over here, spraying their chemtrails on us, and our lands are being taken up. And the police force is more and more active, and it's just terrible what's going on in the world today. We have very serious problems, and I don't know how to address them or deal with them or anything. It's really quite a shocking case.
I can add to your list, Christopher.
You can add to my list?
Add to your list, yes, because Homeland Security has acquired 1.5 billion rounds of .40 caliber hollow point ammunition, which is not even permissible for use in warfare under the Geneva Conventions. Homeland Security does not conduct operations abroad. Therefore, all of this ammunition is for operations here at home in the continental United States. Plus, Congress has authorized the use of 30,000 drones to survey us. That's 600 drones per each of the 50 states, and I'm willing to bet they're not merely surveillance drones, but probably predator drones, too. There's been, through the fusion center, a federalization of state and local police so that we no longer can take for granted the cordial relations with our local police department, which has always in the past served as a buffer, a humane interface with law enforcement. And, of course, there are 300 or 400 FEMA camps around the country, about which I have written in an article entitled From America to America, the Endgame, with Dennis Camino, which you can find on Veterans Today. The situation is indeed quite dire.
Yeah, absolutely, Jim. And this is my guest, Jim Fetzer. And I'd like to just make a comment about Jim before I bring him on and he takes part in our interview today. Jim's an amazing man. He investigated the Kennedy assassination for however many years, 30 or 40 years. He's investigated 9/11. He's continually up on what's happening in American politics. I consider Jim really to be an American hero, a person who stood out there on the front edge of what's happening in our society and has made some efforts to try to do something. And he's an amazing character. I wish I had more time to speak with him, but he's an amazing character. He's got a wonderful laugh, and he's really quite something what he's done in terms of fighting back the tooth of the dragon who's attempting to devour us here. So anyway, this is Jim Fetzer. Hi, Jim.
Oh, Christopher, thank you for those very kind words. I must say of late I've been focusing on the Middle East and Israel's attempt to promote a third world war. Anyone who wants to see some of my publications on this, which have included in the Iran Review and in the Tehran Times, can go to Veterans Today, Jim Fetzer, and take a look at my last four or five articles, where you'll also find, as Christopher implied, a dozen or more on JFK and a whole lot more about 9/11.
Yeah, and we'll. I hope today at the end of the show, particularly, Jim, we can come back to discuss your work on Iran and Israel and so on. But I would like for us to try to get through some of the what's happening with the 9/11 truth movement, and there's some kind of major things that have occurred there. And so maybe we can begin with that and then move from there, and we'll talk about Israel and Iran and such.
Okay, certainly, so, that's great, Christopher. Okay, of course, the point of departure is the Vancouver hearings, which were held 15 to 17 June 2012, just a couple of months ago in Vancouver, where I and Joshua Blakeney, with the assistance of Kevin Barrett, brought together 19 speakers, experts on different aspects of 9/11, where we established, number one, that no Boeing 757 hit the Pentagon. There are 9/11 truth groups that aren't even willing to address the issue, but the evidence is simply overwhelming. We established, second of all, that the Twin Towers that were brought down preponderantly by the use of mini and micro nukes, even though other techniques may also have played a role, but nanothermite, for example, would not have had the explosive capacity to convert those 500,000-ton buildings into millions of cubic yards of very fine dust. Then, in addition, going beyond the Pentagon to the other alleged crash sites at Shanksville, the North and the South Tower, we, including you, Christopher, who made a very fascinating presentation about this question, established that all four of those crash sites were fabricated or faked, that Flight 11 did not hit the North Tower, that Flight 77 did not hit the Pentagon, that Flight 93 did not crash in Shanksville, Flight 175 did not hit the South Tower. And in addition, we discovered evidence from pilots for 9/11 Truth, which has done brilliant studies, that while Flights 93 and 175 were in the air that day, unlike Flights 11 and 77, Flight 93 was over Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, after it had allegedly crashed in Shanksville. And that Flight 175 was over Harrisburg and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, long after it had allegedly hit the South Tower. And then finally, we had a mountain of evidence about who was responsible and why, implicating the American neocons, half of whom are joint U.S.-Israeli citizens and the Mossad. There was a tremendous amount of evidence. If anyone would like to refresh themselves about it, they should check out the website entitled Israel Did 9/11, All the Proof in the World. Even though Israel could not have arranged for the stand down of the U.S. Air Force on 9/11, nor for the Pentagon to be attacked, which is clear evidence, and we've gone into this extensively, of complicity between the highest levels of the American government and the Mossad. In fact, it's fair to say, Christopher, as you know, that all of our evidence supports the conclusion that this was a national security event that was authorized by the highest levels of the American government, the CIA, the NSA, the Pentagon, and the White House, so that everyone in government was in the know. And that's part of the reason why everyone in the government has been so eager to cover it up.
Yeah, it's terrible. What's happened in our society is just unbelievable, that this was carried off in this way and involved so many different people and such. Let's go back to a few of the things that you mentioned along the way. You kind of began a little bit with the Pentagon and said there was no Boeing that hit the Pentagon. What do you see as responsible for the crash site at the Pentagon?
Well, that's a great question, Christopher. And let me just mention for your listeners that most of the presentations or the PowerPoints on which they were based can be found at the Vancouver Hearings website. If you simply scroll down to the program, you'll see each of the titles of the presentation that's read is an active link. Plus, if they go to Veterans Today, there are two articles specifically on the Vancouver hearings, both of which are entitled 9/11 Truth Will Out, the Vancouver Hearings 1, and 9/11 Truth Will Out, the Vancouver Hearings 2. Plus, if you look at my more recent articles, you'll see additional information about the involvement of the Mossad, which is, as I have already indicated, clear and compelling. Now, what we found about the Pentagon, Christopher, is that the official account of a Boeing 757 barely skimming the ground and taking out multiple lampposts on an acute northeast trajectory before hitting the building is both aerodynamically and physically impossible. That a Boeing 757 at 500 miles an hour could not get closer than 60 or even 80 feet to the ground because of what is known as ground effect, which is the accumulation of a pocket of compressed gas beneath a fuselage. The only way planes are actually able to land is because they fly slower and slower as they come to the ground, and that pocket of air shrinks or diminishes to enable them to land. So that means the official trajectory isn't even aerodynamically possible. The idea then of a plane traveling 500 miles an hour hitting a series of stationary lampposts becomes absurd when you note that, according to the government, it did not affect the trajectory of the aircraft, because the impact of a plane traveling 500 miles an hour hitting a stationary lamppost would be the same as a stationary plane being hit by a lamppost traveling 500 miles an hour. It would have ripped off the wing. The fuel inside would have burst into flame. It would have twisted, its tail broken off, and cartwheeled into the ground. Instead, what we have is a clear, green, unblemished Pentagon lawn, which remains that way for 20 or 30 minutes after the alleged attack. We have photograph after photograph after photograph of the clear, green, unblemished lawn.
Yeah.
Another study you can find that accents this is one entitled, "What Didn't Happen at the Pentagon?"
Oh, yeah.
But in addition, Christopher, as you know, I mean, at the alleged crash site, which is on the ground floor, it's only about 10 feet high, 16, 17 feet wide. There is a chain link fence, a couple of automobiles, two enormous spools of cable, unbroken windows, but no massive pile of debris from a 100-ton airliner, no wings, no bodies, no seats, no luggage, no tail. Christopher, some of your listeners will be astonished to discover that not even the engines were recovered.
Yeah.
So the whole official account is a complete fantasy. And what we have discovered, pilots obtained alleged black box data from Flight 77, which we know from Bureau of Transportation Statistics records was actually not even scheduled to fly that day, for a plane on a completely different trajectory, a due east trajectory, north of the Citgo station, by the way, whereas the official trajectory would be south. That was 300 feet in the air, too high to hit any lamppost. 1 second from the building was 100 feet in the air. It swerved over it at the same time explosives were set off. We actually have many witnesses found by CIT that report seeing a plane approach the Pentagon north of the Citgo, which, as I say, contradicts the official account, which would have been south of the Citgo. But the trucker buddy of a friend of mine from JFK Research, a fellow named Dave Ball, was actually in front of the Pentagon, told my friend Roy Schaefer that he had seen a plane fly toward the Pentagon and then swerve over it. And so I asked Roy if Dave would be willing to come on my show. He told me Dave was reluctant to do so. And unfortunately, many witnesses don't realize that once they have gone public, they are much less targets, because a few weeks later, he was found dead in an abandoned building.
Wow. Goodness. So what it seems at the Pentagon was that there were explosives within the building, and then there's some question still, I think, about whether there might have been a missile. Like, I remember seeing that clip you had where I thought the missile was fired out of the Pentagon lawn and traveled across the lawn. Did you ever look at that clip?
Well, Gordon Duff was the senior editor of Veterans Today, and who has excellent contacts with the intelligence agencies, gave me that clip and has asserted that it's bona fide. I have been seeking independent grounds to make that determination, but I agree with you that there is some possibility. In fact, the Pentagon has only ever released 5 frames related to the actual hit, 4 of which are fireball frames, which I believe now to have been faked, because when the excavation was done on the section of the Pentagon that would collapse about 30 minutes after the original hit, there were no signs of any fire damage to that part of the building, even including on the third floor, a wooden stand with what appears to be an Oxford Unabridged Dictionary that's not even singed. So that I'm doubtful about the fireballs. But the other frame is most interestingly, it's conveniently labeled plane. And as you can see, just above a gate mechanism, there is the silhouette of a small aircraft, which I thought too small to be a Boeing 757. So I asked Jack White, a legendary photo analyst from JFK Research, who's also done extensive studies before 9/11, recently departed, alas, and he introduced the the image of a 757 to that photograph, scaling it to the tail, and the 757, which is 155 feet long, is more than twice as long as that plane, which therefore could have been a small fighter aircraft, an F-14 or whatever. Some have suggested an A-3 Sky Warrior. And it's exuding a trail of white smoke, which both pilots and aeronautical engineers have explained to me could not be from the jet exhaust of the plane, which would be black, but could be from a missile being fired at the building. So I do agree with you, Christopher, that there may be some questions about the possibility of a missile having been fired at the Pentagon, which have yet to be resolved.
And which might have been shot from the Pentagon's lawn.
I say that. Yeah, the Pentagon is the most heavily defended building in the world. It has all kinds of anti-missile batteries and so forth surrounding it. And if it had not, you know... We have from Norman Mineta, of course, the fascinating report from the bunker underneath the White House that an aide had approached Cheney, who seems to have been in charge on 9/11, and reported, sir, it's 50 miles out, sir, it's 40 miles out, sir, it's 30 miles out.
Oh, yeah.
As a plane approached the building, the plane being one, I take it, that was 300 feet in the air too high, that flew toward the building and then swerved over it as a form of distraction at the same time that explosives were set off. But when he asked whether the order still stood, Cheney turned up, whipped his head around, and said, "Have you heard anything to the contrary?" Which means, of course, though Norman Mineta was unclear what it meant, that there was an order to not shoot down the plane. Shooting the plane down would have been the obvious thing to do. You lose the plane and the passengers, of course, but you don't also lose the personnel and the property of the target, which is, you know, what happened here, but it was faked. I mean... And the reason it appears to have been fake, Christopher, is that Donald Rumsfeld apparently instructed the section chief who was doing research on the $2.3 trillion Rumsfeld had reported missing from the Pentagon budget the day before. I believe he instructed his section chief to have all of his experts and all the documents and records there in the East Wing so that they could be destroyed during the strike. So that, you know, I'm convinced that part of the reason for the simulation was to get rid of those records. And, of course, we have multiple witnesses who were on the scene, including April Gallup, who walked out this big hole and looked around and saw no signs of any aircraft. We have Jamie McIntyre for CNN on the scene very promptly, who, in response to a question from the anchor, said that he had, you know, when he asked about the plane hitting the building, he said, well, you might think that, but from this close-up inspection, there was no indication of any large plane having hit anywhere near the Pentagon. Plus, we have the expert report from General Albert Stubblebine, who was in charge of all U.S. military photographic intelligence, who told a German reporter that he'd studied the photographs of the Pentagon, and he was convinced no plane had hit the Pentagon for the simple reason that there was no imprint of any wings on the side of the Pentagon, where the walls are 2 feet thick, a foot of concrete, 8 inches of brick, and then 4 inches of limestone, which is a very soft, porous stone. So that if, in fact, a plane had hit there, it would have been pretty obvious. You would have been able to see it. So I think we have an overwhelming amount of evidence that no Boeing 757 hit the building, although, as Christopher observes, there's some lingering questions here about the possible use of a missile.
Yeah, and but mainly it seems also, though, that we're being told it was blown up from inside, and that's something that Barbara Honinger said on your show yesterday?
That's correct. She did say that.
Yeah.
And she reported that Barbara has done a great deal of work on the Pentagon and is certainly one of the leading experts on the Pentagon. And during an interview last night on my show, The Real Deal, she reported that there were evidence reports that the building had been blown from the inside out, which, of course, is completely inconsistent with the official account. All of this seems to me to hang together the right way to demonstrate that the official account is hopelessly false and that they took steps to create a fantasy scenario to deceive the American people, including, by the way, dropping debris apparently done by the C-130 that was circling the building, because there was no debris there for 20 or 30 minutes. I mean, I made quite a point of this. For example, when I was interviewed by the BBC for 8 hours for its first conspiracy files, documentary. And then they used 7.5 minutes of me, 4 minutes of Alex Jones, 3.5 of Dylan Avery. They spent the rest of that 45 minutes with psychobabble, you know, trying to explain why anyone would believe these crackpot theories, addressing nothing about all the evidence I've explained or the reasoning that substantiated the conclusions we've been discussing. And then when they did the second, Christopher, they came back to my house for 4 hours more.
Wow.
Because I said, if you're willing to do it right, I'd be glad to cooperate. And this time, you know, when I spelled all this out very explicitly, when they produced the documentary, they simply switched the photographs. So whereas I was talking about the clear green Pentagon lawn, they were offering photographs from much later showing debris on the lawn. So that I wrote an expose of what they had done with ample photographs illustrating my points, which anyone can find at Veterans Today under the title, The BBC's Instrument of 9/11 Misinformation.
Okay, so then you discuss the Pentagon. Then you're saying, and I agree with you, of course, that there were no planes that hit any of the targets that day. And you've recited some evidence that two of the planes were not decommissioned until, I think, 4 or 5 years later, and then two others were in service even longer than that.
Actually, Gerard Holmgren, who was an Australian blues magician, noticed almost immediately that Bureau of Transportation Statistics record shows that Flight 11 and 77 were not even scheduled that day. Plus, FAA registration data that I have in my possession shows that the planes corresponding to flights 93 and 175 were not taken out of service, deregistered until 28 September 2005, which raises the question, how can planes that weren't even in the air have crashed on 9/11? And how can planes that crashed on 9/11 have still been in the air 4 years later? All of which has been buttressed by studies of, you know, the crash sites and so forth, where the most interesting case, of course, is New York, where we have what purport to be videos of the planes hitting the building. But whatever they are, they cannot be Flights 11, which wasn't in the air, or 175, which was over Harrisburg and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, long after its alleged crash. The question becomes, what sort of fakery was involved there, Christopher? But there's something out there called no planes theory, which amounts to the conjunction of those four propositions I mentioned before, namely that Flight 11 did not hit the North Tower, 77 did not hit the Pentagon, 93 did not crash in Shanksville, and 175 did not hit the South Tower. We have all that established firmly before we go to try to figure out what was going on in New York, which is a really quite a fascinating case and to which you made a powerful contribution with your presentation in Vancouver.
Yeah, thank you. I was really quite pleased with that. And it still leaves it up in the air what was really done. I mean, that's what I found even with my presentations. Like, you can see that some of the videos, they're either video graphics or holograms of non-existent planes, but it still leaves it up in the air a little bit. Like, you've mentioned that you think that they were actually holograms projected of an airplane, and I think that's a very feasible idea.
Well, the fact of the matter is that the plane seen in the video is traveling faster than a standard 767 could travel at that altitude, about 560 miles an hour, which is its cruising speed at 35,000 feet. But at 700 to 1,000 feet where these events were taking place, the air is three times denser. The turbines can't suck it through fast enough and begin functioning as brakes. Plus, the plane enters the building effortlessly. We have, in violation of Newton's laws, I mean, it's intersecting with the South Tower plane is intersecting with eight different floors consisting of steel trusses connected to the core columns filled with 4 to 8 inches of concrete and then the external steel support columns. So it's actually, you know, intersecting with 8 acres of concrete. We know what happens with a plane when it hits a small bird in flight, it can do enormous damage, even though the bird only weighs a few ounces. Well, imagine one of these planes hitting an acre of concrete on a steel truss. I mean, it boggles the mind. And yet this plane effortlessly passes into the building. It doesn't even slow down. Mm-hmm. Christopher, we've done by-frame analysis of both the Evan Fairbanks and the Heather Connie videos. We find that the plane disappears or passes its whole length into the South Tower in the same number of frames it passes through its whole length in air, which is clearly a physical impossibility. So not only do you have no collision effects, but you have the plane showing no deceleration whatsoever. Plus, of course, it should have exploded on contact with a building external to the building. Instead, it passes all the way through into the building before it explodes. And if it had the capacity to pass through the one side so effortlessly, surely it would have come out the other side, because the plane itself is only 160 feet long, but the building is 208 feet wide. So this implies that the plane had to come to a screeching halt within 48 feet, which I've calculated, Christopher, at 500 miles an hour to travel 48 feet would take place in 56/1,000th of a second. I mean, anyone who believes this plane could have come to a screeching halt inside the building in 56/1,000th of a second, I think simply doesn't understand the nature of mass, velocity, and elementary physics.
Yeah, absolutely. That's absolutely true. And I know when I showed my first video of the gaping hole in the South Tower, and I tried to point out how there were a whole series of the outside cladding which had been split off, but they were all done in a row across the top. And you could see that obviously a plane going into that building at that kind of angle could never have split all those beams off in that row shown across the top of the video.
I thought you did a wonderful job, Christopher, not only of showing that there were features present on the facade that should not have been present had a plane actually passed there, but also that there were features that were absent that should have been present had a plane actually gone in there, including, of course, massive piles of aluminum from the plane. And as you have remarked, too, if all that jet fuel then was, you know, burning up, how could Edna Cintrone have been there standing in that opening, gape looking down? You know, I mean, there's just no indication of any plane having actually hit the building, apart from the videos, where the question becomes, how was the fakery done? We already know what's taking place is something that looks like a plane, but it's performing feats that no real plane could perform, which means that we're dealing with some kind of fakery, where three hypotheses have emerged. One is computer-generated images. Rose Grable, in particular, has advanced that. Video compositing. Ace Baker has recommended that. And then the idea of the use of a hologram, which John Lear, our nation's most distinguished pilot, has endorsed, as has Stefan Grossman, who's done a study of the absence of collision effects, as has Stephen Brown, whom I interviewed on my show, who had just taken a course in holography at Cambridge, who assured me the technology was available to have done this. And now we have the new research by Richard Hall, an English student of 9/11, who had taken the large number of videos of Flight 175, reportedly 175 approaching the building, well, of which there are about 52, he found 26 or 27 that were useful to locate locations and times. So he did a plot of locations and times of what we see in the video. And then discovered that the NTSB had a similar plot of locations and times, which corresponded to him, which it claimed was based on radar data, but where he was very suspicious that it wasn't real radar data because the graphs they had that were supposed to substantiate it looked artificial or faked. He subsequently did discover, however, that there was military radar data for a plane approaching the Pentagon, the South Tower, but to his astonishment, it was approaching 1,400 feet to the right of the image, at each point in time, and there appears to have been projecting the hologram, and because the plane projecting the hologram was making real noises, real sounds of a plane, they were associated with the image of the plane, the fake image, and created the impression this was a real plane, where the plane that was projecting must have been cloaked. He not only found this for the South, but he also did the same study for the North and found the same phenomenon, that there was a radar track for a plane 1,400 feet to the side, which wow. appears to have been projecting the image. This is brilliant stuff, Christopher. And, of course, any of your listeners can find it by going to Richard Hall, 3D Radar Study Flight 175. Just use that for your search keywords, and it'll pop up. It's quite fascinating.
He also found that for the North Tower, did he?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, I hadn't realized that. That's very interesting. Yeah.
He studied the dust, you know, that initially obscured after the hit points, which actually appear to be four. They form like a Z pattern when whatever it was at the North Tower, and it doesn't look anything like a Boeing 767, yeah. allegedly hits the building. But after the dust clears, it's turned into an elongated V. So it's initially a four-point Z figure. Now it's turned into an elongated V. And what he noticed that no one else had noticed before is, if you look at the dust very carefully, there's a little points of light that are appearing all over the place. And I have observed before, was this perhaps what George Herbert Walker Bush was talking about with his 1,000 points of light? But it appears to have been, you know, many explosions that were cutting out, creating the little cutout, the artificial cutout, that looks like a cartoon. I mean, you know, if you're raised on Roadrunner, you know, animations, and, you know, when the Roadrunner runs through a boulder, it creates an exact image of the Roadrunner. Well, that's what we have here in this steel and concrete building. And in the case of the North Tower, by the way, it's intersecting with seven of those floors, steel trusses with 4 to 8 inches of concrete. I mean, this is all physically and aerodynamically absurd, but that's what the government has been trying to sell us.
Yeah. Well, okay. So, let me see. Going back here.
I didn't mention Shanksville. Shanksville is the easiest of them all. I mean, the first two reporters on the scene both reported that the eerie aspect of the crash site was there was no sign that any plane had crashed there. The medical examiner said he ceased being coroner after 15 minutes because there was no body parts, no nothing. He would later observe he hadn't found a single speck of blood. The government has claimed that the plane disappeared into soft ground because it had been an area that had been subjected to mining. One variation has it that the plane disappeared into an abandoned mine shaft. Well, we know what to do, Christopher, with miners trapped in mine shafts. We get out the bright lights, the heavy equipment, and we dig 24/7 in the hope by some miracle someone might have survived. They didn't do that in this instance, of course, because it would have been hugely embarrassing to the government and reduced its theory of the case to absurdity to have had bright lights and heavy equipment there digging for a plane and passengers that did not even exist.
It's and so absurd.
The public attention would have been gripped by this had it actually taken place. So instead, they sort of tidy things up, and they actually trimmed the brushes and trees that had been singed to make sure no one could do a chemical analysis to determine that whatever had caused them to burn it had not been jet fuel. And subsequently, the EPA came out to do a study of the ground because it ought to have been saturated with thousands of gallons of jet fuel and found no signs of any jet fuel.
Okay, so what we've seen then is that all four of the planes were not crash-landed at any of the sites, but somehow they tried to fabricate an image of an airplane at those sites.
Right. Four of the crash sites are fabricated or faked. And, of course, if there were no plane crashes, then there were no dead passengers aboard those planes. We've already noted that the passenger manifest didn't include the names of any Arabic persons, much less any Islamic terrorists. But if the planes were all phantom flights, if none of them crashed as advertised, then there were no passengers, there were no hijackers aboard the plane, and therefore there were no Arab terrorists who hijacked the planes, which means that the entire war on terror was based upon a fantasy, a phony story, a myth.
Yeah.
And it turns out that Zelikow, who was an insider from the Bush-Cheney administration, who was appointed the executive director of the 9/11 Commission, had as his area of academic specialization before he joined the government, Christopher, the creation and maintenance of public myths. I can't believe how well he was chosen for this, but there is the man, the perfect man, to provide us with the myth of 9/11, Philip Zelikow.
Wow. Yeah, exactly. And so that's then what the conference went into, was also looking at who is behind it and tying it into the Mossad and the Israeli government.
Right. And of course, we also spent time on the Twin Towers and how they were destroyed. In fact, we had two sessions.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Mm-hmm. Session devoted to the Twin Towers, considered alternative theories. That it was a collapse, as the government claims, or that it could have been done using nanothermite, or that possibly directed energy weapons were used, or that it was done using some sophisticated arrangement of micro or mini nukes. And Chuck Baldwin demonstrated conclusively that given the design and engineering of the building, it was physically impossible for the building to collapse. I mean, you know, too many Americans are taken in not realizing the difference between a collapse and a demolition. If they look at Building 7, take, for example, the little video entitled This is an Orange, they'll see all the floors come down at the same time. They do fall at about the speed of free fall, which implies that all the internal supports have been removed. And subsequently, there's a stack of pancakes or floors that equal to about 12% of the height of the original for the 47 floors. It turns out to be about 5.5 floors. In the case of the Twin Towers, if that happens, since those are 110-story buildings, there should have been, you know, 12, 13 or more floors worth of debris.
Yeah.
But in fact, they were reduced below ground level. And what you have with the Twin Towers is both buildings blowing apart in every direction from the top down. Now, that blowing apart in every direction contradicts the idea of a gravitationally driven collapse, because gravity only works in one direction. So we had to have some massive force of energy that was blowing these buildings apart in every direction. And then, of course, the buildings are being converted into millions of cubic yards of very fine dust. I mean, you know, this is... Even the gross observable evidence, in other words, reduces the government's official account of the Twin Towers to rubble. The government's account is reduced to rubble, because when it was over, the Twin Towers, there was nothing left. They were reduced to ground level. There was no stack of pancakes at all. So Chuck showed that multiple ways. Jeff Prager and Donald Fox explained how the dust samples collected by the United States Geological Survey. Now, this is not private investigators. This is the government's own geological survey. Showed masses of elements that should not have been present if it had been a collapse, for example, including deuterium and strontium and cesium and a host of others, tritium, that ought not to have been there. Where I do believe now, you see in retrospect, that the idea of doing this, the nanothermite group, the thermite sniffers, you know, claiming to have based their research on the dust samples, well, they only reported one feature found in the dust, these little tiny iron spiracles, which, you know, required very great heat to produce, but would be perfectly expectable from a micro or mini nuke event. But they excluded all the other important elements in the dust. So I think in many ways what was going on there was an operation intended to distract us, to make us think that there had been serious study of the dust, when in fact that was not the case, and that it remained for Jeff Prager and Don Fox and the anonymous physicist and others to get deeply involved in the study of the dust, where they've done a brilliant job, and where, you know, Claire Kuhn did her best to stand up for the idea of dues. But, you know, Judy Wood's own work is incredibly vague. All she actually says about directed energy weapons is that what was involved here at the Twin Towers required a source of energy far greater than conventional explosives could provide, and that was capable of being directed. But we all know that. So what that means is her claim or definition of directed energy weapons is satisfied by arrangements of micro or mini nukes, and indeed would be satisfied by others. There's this one theory of nukes, 150 kiloton nukes at the basements of each of the three big buildings by Dmitry Kolesov, but that would require the buildings to be destroyed from the bottom up, because he's got it in the sub-basement, you know, blowing up, or it also would have shattered the bathtub, which is this diver moat within which the Twin Towers were constructed to keep Hudson River water out, so that if it had been shattered, then Hudson River water would have flooded beneath lower Manhattan, the most valuable real estate in the world, the path train tunnels, the subway tunnels. It would have been horrendous. In fact, it appears clear in retrospect the reason they had to design an ingenious new technique to demolish the buildings. So what we have is a demolition under control with the Twin Towers, as opposed to a classic controlled demolition with Building 7, was to save the bathtub and thereby preserve lower Manhattan from the massive damage that would have occurred had the bathtub been damaged. So this is all really quite fascinating stuff. Dwayne Dietz then took assess the four different theories being considered and evaluated them based upon multiple criteria. I think he was using 9 different criteria, and found that the evidence overwhelmingly supported the use of mini or micro nukes as opposed to the other alternatives.
Yeah, it definitely seems to me that is the onus is on the mini nukes now. Like, that's what I mean, there may be something else that might modify that, but it seems at this moment that explains what happened, especially the way that they would be placed at different levels and coordinated.
Look at this. The NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, reported that the South Tower had been destroyed in 9 seconds, the North Tower in 11. If you had an arrangement of mini nukes that were taking out 10 floors at a whack per second, and to take out 110 stories at 10 floors a whack per second would require 11 seconds, as in the case of the North Tower. Where the South Tower event is different because the top 30 floors tilt over and are destroyed as a single group all at once. So there you have, 8 floors plus 1 second for the top 3, and it turns out to be then 9 seconds. So I think this account also corresponds to the timeline specified by the government itself.
Yeah, it does. Okay, so... Well, those were some of the details, and then beyond that, the group went into who was behind it, and with quotations about the Mossad and the dancing Israelis, and there's really so much evidence that really points to the Mossad, even though it strikes me that some of the events ascribed to the Mossad, it doesn't mean that the Mossad was behind it so much. Like, what I'm trying to say is the events ascribed to the Mossad, like the dancing Israelis who all lit their light bulbs when the buildings fell down, those people, they might play a minor role like that, but there was obviously other heavier duty people in the different industries. I'm not sure exactly what I'm trying to say. I guess one thing that strikes me at time is, why do we think it's only Israel? Because also we also have all these Israeli agents all through our governments. It strikes me that it's not just Israel, but it could also be these other elements within our own society.
Well, of course, you're absolutely right. And that's why I said when I mentioned the website, Israel did 9/11, all the proof of the world, which goes all the way through from the transfer of the World Trade Center from public ownership by the Port Authority of New York to Silverstein Properties for the first time in its history, which only took place 6 weeks before 9/11, but also talks about ICTS, the Israeli security firm that was operating at the airports that were involved, the Odego messaging service, which appears to have warned a whole lot of Jewish, workers in the vicinity not to go there, and on and on and on. It had to have involved elements of the American government, and the neocons are the obvious candidates. Many of them had joint U.S.-Israeli citizenship. The first political speech I ever gave, Christopher, was on 15 April 2008 on the grass outside of the Capitol in Washington, D.C., where I was talking about the role of the neocons and how can we allow persons who have joint citizenship with another country to have high decision-making or policy-forming positions when their loyalty to the other country might outweigh their loyalty to the United States. And I called for them all to resign or be fired from the government. I mean, it's completely outrageous, but there's no question at all about what the stand down of the American Air Force that took place that morning, where Webster Tarpley in later editions of his book of 9/11 Synthetic Terror Made in the USA, reports anywhere from 17 up to as many as 47 different little anti-terrorist ops that were intended to take the American Air Force out of action so that, you know, there'd be no fighters to go up to intercept the phantom flights. I mean, I don't know if you recall the wonderful film War Games, where the Whopper, which is the computer running War Games for NORAD, which is located in a mountain in Colorado, goes, and gets involved in a mode where it thinks it's actually involved in a bona fide thermonuclear war with the Soviet Union. And at one point, it's reporting, you know, two Soviet bombers over Alaska. So General Barrington sends up a couple of planes to check it out, and they report back to the Crystal Palace, no general, nothing here, sky's all clear, which is what Rumsfeld and Cheney and the others involved in planning 9/11 did not want to happen. They didn't want American planes to go out and reveal that these were all phantom flights. And what indications, by the way, that of Pentagon complicity is that once it went live, once you have these reports that actual hijackings were taking place, all the artificial blips, all the phony blips on all the air screens for the drill ought to have been removed. But they were not, Christopher. They were left in place, which meant that the air control, traffic control operators couldn't tell whether it was live or Memorex. They had a mess on their hands. They couldn't even tell which were the real planes. And that all has to have been deliberate, as well as the attack on the Pentagon could never have been allowed to happen unless the Pentagon had wanted it to happen. So you're absolutely right. It wasn't just the Mossad. It also was the American military and the CIA, where international experts on intel have all concurred that there were only two intelligence agencies in the world that could have pulled it off. One was the CIA, and the other was the Mossad.
So there we have it, kind of like it's the CIA at the highest levels. These people are protecting the public from knowing the truth about 9/11. So instead of working for,
not only did Bush and Cheney put off even having an investigation for 441 days, but when it took place, they were only willing to testify if it were not under oath, if there were no transcript taken, and if they could testify together. I mean, this is the behavior you expect from mafia dons, not from the president and the vice president of the United States. I mean, it's very revealing. It's what under the law is known as consciousness of guilt. They didn't want to go on the record because they didn't want later to have their own words come back to haunt them for having committed perjury, so that if they did not testify under oath and no transcript were taken, they could not be found guilty of perjury, no matter what whoppers they had told, and they were there to support, you know, one of the great monstrous hoax of all time, namely the official account of 9/11.
And so now we have the CIA and the FBI are really protecting the people who committed 9/11. Really, I mean, that's
absolutely true, Christopher. And
it's very sad. It's very sad. You know, it makes you wonder, like, holy smokes, where are our police and our intelligence? It's like none of them work for us. You know, none of them work for the American people. They work for these psychopaths. And it's terrible because all the people below those higher up levels, I mean, most of the people in those organizations don't support that kind of terrorism. perpetrated by their higher officers. It's terrible.
And most of those who were involved, you know, in one role or another had no idea they were part of a larger scheme that was to perpetrate this deception, this hoax on the American people. But from my research on JFK and on the death of Paul Wellstone, I have discovered multiple instances of the FBI being used to cover up crimes. And it's also true of the National Transportation Safety Board. It turns out to be a policy of the NTSB that they cannot investigate a crash scene as a crime scene unless the Attorney General declares it to be one. So if you have a complicit or compliant Attorney General, you have the perfect scenario for eliminating your political opponents. You take them down in the plane crash and simply have the Attorney General not declare it to be a crime scene. That's what happened in the Wellstone plane crash. The NTSB only investigated the possibility that it had been the plane, the pilots, or the weather. They never considered a small bomb or a gas canister or some kind of high-tech weapon. So they never investigated that it could have been a form of sabotage. Plus this, Christopher, you're going to find this unbelievable. It's also the NTSB policy that their reports are not admissible as evidence in courts of law. So clearly their function is purely public relations and to cover up crimes committed by the government, where in the case of 9/11, no investigation was ever done of any of the four crash sites, and for the excellent reason, no planes had actually crashed.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, so, well, today we've kind of gone through many of the new features that came out at the Vancouver conference, and listening to your talk yesterday with Barbara, it was amazing to me to hear how much she had been censored when she had to speak at the Toronto conference. So really, the Vancouver conference opens this up in a very different way, because I think here we see there was no plane at the Pentagon, and there was micro nukes and all these other features that hadn't been added at the Toronto conference, and they in a way had tried to limit their sphere of expertise. So now we've had this Vancouver conference, and I know at the end of the conference there was a hope that perhaps this conference now, because we had two judges who were going to kind of review some of the proceedings from the conference and hopefully attempt to take those forward to some international court. And then now we come to the next factor of, wow, it was really unusual what happened in terms of the judges in this conference and kind of what became of what they had intended to do. I don't know how you want to introduce this, Jim, but, you know, maybe talk a little bit about Alfred Weber, and I don't know Connie's role in the whole thing. I'm not sure of that. But certainly what happened with Alfred was really very unusual.
Well, let's begin with the Toronto hearings. They made a deliberate decision to be very conservative and to only discuss issues about which there was broad general agreement, which had to do fairly exclusively then with the destruction or damage done to the World Trade Center, where several of those involved here are still enthusiasts about nanothermite, even though T. Mark Hightower, who's a chemical engineer, and I had published articles about it before the Toronto hearings, demonstrating that nanothermite cannot possibly have been the principal causal mechanism for destroying the Twin Towers, because it turns out to be a principle of material science that in order to destroy a material, you must have a detonation velocity equal to or greater than the speed of sound in that material. Yeah. The speed of sound in concrete is 3,200 meters per second, and steel, 6,100 meters per second. But the highest detonation velocity attributed to nanothermite is only 895 meters per second, which means you can't get there from there. Some of the defenders of nanothermite say, well, yes, but if you combine it with an explosive, then you could, achieve the desired effect. But as I point out, that's also true with toothpaste. If you combine it with an explosive, you could have explosive effects. The point is that nanothermite is non-explosive, or at best, if you want to stretch the meaning of the world, is a feeble or weak explosive. It only has 1/13 the explosive force of TNT, which is the universal standard. So to suppose those buildings could have been blown apart by nanothermite is a fantasy. Plus, Mark Hightower had asked Niels Harrod how much nanothermite would have been required to do the job, and Niels Harrod came back with a figure of 29,000 metric tons, which would have the amount of time it would have taken to emplace, this is just a fantasy. This is unrealistic. And I must confess that I now believe in retrospect that it was intended to be a misleading, a blind alley, a distraction, a red herring. I'm very upset about this. Now, Toronto, therefore, really didn't want to go the places we went. It didn't want to explore the Pentagon, though finally, belatedly, as Barbara explained, she was invited to speak, but only on the condition that she talk about damage to the buildings and not talk about the planes. That's a fairly absurd constraint. And then there was no discussion really about who was responsible or why. I mean, there were a couple of vague allusions, but nothing specific. Certainly, the list of culprits that we've identified in the Vancouver hearings was nowhere present during the Toronto. And, of course, the idea that the crash sites could all have been faked or fabricated was an idea that was anathema to them. So, as Barbara suggested, that was a very conservative, restrained approach, which had actually very explicit conditions. So after she gave her presentation, one of their panel, they had a panel of four judges as well, asked, well, what about the planes? And she had to turn to those who had invited her here to ask if she could answer the question. And they said, sheepishly, I mean, I think they were a little upset, embarrassed to be caught about this, that she could. And she went ahead and started talking about the planes. And he asked specifically, did she believe that a plane, 757, had hit the building? And she said, no, it had not, but that she was not at liberty to talk about the planes because of constraints that had been imposed upon her by those who organized the hearing when they invited her to speak. I think he was dumbfounded. I mean, how disillusioning could it be to discover that the evidence you're being presented contrived? And I must tell you that I separately had sent, and I don't know if it got to the judges or not, the copies of the articles Mark Hightower and I had published, demonstrating that nanothermite couldn't possibly have been the causal mechanism. So if you compare that with the Vancouver hearings, which were quite liberal, instead of being so constrained that at the Vancouver hearings, we were looking at all theories and all approaches and trying to compare them. See, it's one of the blunders of Stephen Jones' conception of scientific methodology that you can do successful research one hypothesis at a time. But that's wrong. You can't just determine that one hypothesis looks plausible and therefore that's correct. You have to compare it with the alternatives. And it's only you've compared it with the alternatives and determined that it has a higher degree of explanatory power given the available evidence, roughly that the hypothesis confers a higher probability on the effects, if you take the hypothesis as the cause, that you can make progress in scientific inquiry, which is what we were doing in Vancouver, but what they were not doing in Toronto. Now, both of these conferences had a quasi-judicial aspect to it in the sense that both had as an aim, not merely discovering the truth through the presentations and exchanges between the contributors and participants, but also submitting what Alfred Weber, who is our senior judge, who had served on the Kuala Lumpur Tribunal, which impressed me greatly, which had brought indictments against Tony Blair and George W. Bush and others for war crimes that had been widely heralded, proposed was submitting, having evidentiary submissions to show how the evidence we presented targeted specific individuals. Or in my case, for example, I prepared five evidentiary submissions, one against Philip Zelikow, one against Donald Rumsfeld, one against Dick Cheney, one against George Bush, and the last against Lieutenant Colonel Stephen O'Brien, who was the pilot of the C-130 circling the Pentagon from which all that debris appears to have been dropped. And others had even more extensive submissions. So we were in the process of submitting these in anticipation of Alfred drafting an indictment for submission to different venues. With the ICC, turns out to be kind of a tricky case because the United States is not presently signatory, and therefore the ICC cannot hear charges against Americans. But because other than Americans were killed, it might be able to hear the aspects of charges related to 9/11 that brought about the deaths of non-Americans. For example, 24 Canadians were killed on 9/11. So there were at least 10 of us who had, you know, of the 19, and some, it appeared, were not going to make submissions. But there were, you know, at least a dozen, maybe 13, who were, and they were well along. We'd extended the deadline for the submissions a couple times when it turned out that, you know, Alfred had been gradually creating a distinction between the Vancouver Tribunal, which was supposed to carry forward these legal aspects, versus the Vancouver hearings. Whereas originally, in its conception, the Vancouver Tribunal was merely supposed to be an extension of the hearings, but he began accepting admissions, one in particular, from a fellow named Andrew Basiago, that had to do with very, very different views that would, you know, raise huge questions of their own about time travel and foreknowledge and so forth. But Basiago claims that he was in a group of, I think it was 140 children back in 1970 who were being trained in time travel and DARPA jump rooms to go from one era to another. He even claimed he'd been in Gettysburg when Lincoln delivered the Gettysburg Address. I knew that Alfred had some unusual views. It had come up very early on when we first announced that he was going to be a judge for the Vancouver Tribunal. A blogger in Vancouver by the name of Russell Scott had sent me a scathing indictment of Alfred, which led me to, because of his unusual views, but it led me to do research to the extent that I discovered the views he was attributing to Alfred were actually from other parties, where Alfred had indeed talked about and apparently believed them, but hadn't made those claims himself. So that I was, I went back and forth with Alfred, especially in collusion with Kevin Barrett, about how we could contain the problem, because I thought that given his excellent work with the Kuala Lumpur Tribunal, that he was probably the perfect guy to be assisting us in Vancouver. He lives in the vicinity. He could do it, you know, at no cost, no transportation or even accommodations and so forth. Plus, he knew someone else, Connie Fogel, who is a wonderful person who could also serve with him as a judge. So what I did was strike an agreement with Alfred. I actually had drafted a response to Russell Scott about all this. But when Kevin and I discussed it, thought that it was necessary to add two more paragraphs about methodological issues and to explain that, you know, whether these claims being made by Basiago and these others were true or false, that it was impossible at present to subject them to any form of evidential test, that they were, you know, basically speculations, and that would require a considerable time and effort to sort out whether or not they were even remotely plausible. So that I sent Alfred, you know, an expanded version that included those two paragraphs, but Alfred didn't want them to be included in my formal response to Russell Scott. So I told Alfred, as long as he'd agreed that his views about these matters should not, you know, become a part of the Vancouver hearings, not be introduced into our proceedings and so forth, that then we could go forward. And he agreed to do that. So I felt that I had contained the problem. What happened then at the tail end is that Alfred apparently still was eager to get this stuff in, which he may sincerely believe. And during a dinner meeting he had with both Barbara Honegger, but also a fellow named Ernst Rudin, R-O-D-I-N, who was a prominent psychiatrist and an expert on EEG, electroencephalogram studies. I mean, a world-class expert on that. We're at dinner where Alfred was talking about all this research with Basiago and all that, and time travel and jump rooms and all that sort of thing. And he was explicitly telling them how he wanted to get this information into the record as an evidentiary submission, but he made a promise to me not to do that. So he was trying to figure out how he could get around his promise to me to not do that and still do it. Well, then I belatedly, I don't know what was last, I think it was last weekend, discovered that he'd actually already accepted the submission from Basiago, even though he told me even, you know, as much as just a week or two before, that he would show it to me before it were accepted into evidence. He went ahead and accepted into evidence. And it was Kevin and Barbara who realized this was a travesty and a contravention of our agreement. And Barbara reported having taken 14 pages of notes, Christopher, right there at the dinner table while this conversation was going on, and that both she and Ernst Rodin had told Alfred emphatically that he should not violate his promise to me, which, however, he went ahead and did anyway, of course. And now it's been exposed. His whole manner has become very different. He's no longer deferential and cooperative. He's arrogant and dismissive. Claim now he has the complete right and entitlement as the Vancouver Tribunal to accept anything he wants to accept, so that most of the rest of us have now formally withdrawn our submissions from his consideration. And Nick Holstrom has a group letter signed by about 12 of us. It's going to be sent tomorrow, too, just to emphasize it. So that of all the participants, there are four that he has submissions from, or promises of submissions. Two who weren't participants in the Vancouver hearings, one the Andrew Basiago, the other Lorraine Morais, who's an independent geoscientist who's done a great deal of research about radiation contamination exposure from Fukushima to Fallujah and so forth, and where I've interviewed her several times on my radio program and hold her in high esteem, where coincidentally I had featured both her and Alfred Weber during the Madison Conference as speakers. So I already had prior contact with them. But she has made a promise to make a submission by the 1st of October. Knowing Lorraine and how many projects she's working on, I doubt very much she's going to make that deadline. But the other two were Dean Hartwell, who had spoken. He's published a book about passengers with planes without passengers, for example. He spoke about the Pentagon. His work has ramifications for the others. And Susan Lindauer, who is a former asset for the CIA, whose indictment or evidentiary submissions I've already actually published on Veterans Today under the heading of, let's see, former 9/11, former CIA asset, I don't know, blows the whistle or something like that. Anyway, it's a very nice piece. I featured her on my radio show, too, and Susan is a very dear person, and I guess, I don't know, she feels kindly toward Alfred. And Dean seems to be taking a very legalistic approach and believes that Alfred hasn't violated any technical conditions, but it's obvious he violated his promise to me. He even admitted as much to Barbara and to Ernest. So now I think the situation is quite unbelievable where, not only had the interview last night to review the bidding, which you heard, Christopher, but also I'm going to publish an article about this. I think it's going to make it very, very clear that this was a duplicitous action on the part of Alfred Weber, that he misled and deceived me. He violated a promise he had made and has caused for us to have to take this matter unto our own hands. So what I'm doing, Christopher, is I'm collating all of our evidentiary submissions and putting them together in the form of an e-book, so we can then submit to parliaments and judicial panels and so forth as appropriate all of the body of evidence we've accumulated. So this is not going to stop us. It's just one more effort to undermine the Vancouver hearings where, as a friend of mine has put it, they threw everything at us. I think that Alfred was their final ace in the hole. And now that he's been exposed.
I agree. I mean, the fact is that this Basaglio, I mean, what he claims about what happened on 9/11 was completely contradictory to everything presented at the conference. I mean, he claimed that there were Muslims hijacking airplanes that flew into the towers, and I mean, that was just part of it. But everything he said was completely contradictory to what had happened at the conference.
if you have the capacity to foresee events in the future, you'd think you'd foresee what actually happens in the future and not the fabricated cover story that would appear in say, the 9/11 Commission report. So I find it just as you incredible on its face. Plus, he has talked about seeing prehistoric animal, a plesiosaurus, as I recall, on Mars. And discovered the image of a plesiosaurus, and it's an aquatic dinosaur that lives in large bodies of water. So far as, you know, any information I have about Mars, there are no large bodies of water on Mars, and it's just, the whole thing is preposterous. And plus, Alfred seems not to consider that this guy might be suffering from false memory syndrome or have been the subject of induced hypnosis to create in him these beliefs, assuming he's sincere. Now, frankly, I think the odds that Alfred is sincere are greater than the odds that Basiago is sincere. Basiago's position is so ridiculous and so unjustified from the point of view of science and research that it's very difficult for me to believe that he can actually believe these things himself, unless, as I say, he's been had the, these beliefs induced by hypnosis or he's suffering from false memory syndrome.
Yeah, something like that. Because it strikes me at times that, in a way, it would have been, in my view, okay if Alfred had wanted to draw other experts in to his submission, but at least having that approved by yourself or other people in the committee, because then we could have brought in other people who also had other angles on what had happened. But then when he brought in this person who claims that this time traveling and he's a DARPA unit and so on, and he's claiming these ridiculous things about what happened on that day, it's really very disgraceful, and it's sure a shame on what happened. But I'm glad to hear you're going to kind of move ahead and try to do something else with the material presented.
They're hardly going to miss a beat because, I mean, the evidentiary submissions were going to go to Alfred, and then he was going to deliberate about them. Instead, you know, I'm putting them together in an e-book, and I can draft an introduction, you know, and we can submit them as appropriate, and we don't have to involve Alfred at all, who has, in my opinion, completely discredited himself. I mean, you know, far from his role as a judge, where he's supposed to be objective and unbiased, he's actually shown what, in retrospect, turns out to be a single-minded determination to introduce this bizarre material into the body of evidence, even though it did not involve anyone who was presenting during the hearings and was something we'd agreed would not be done.
Yeah. Okay, well, it's a shame that it's turned out like that, and I'm really sorry to hear that, because I think a number of people had heard that he was representing the case, and now, those people will be disappointed, but they need to look at the reasons for why he was rejected to support the Vancouver conference.
Well, there are all kinds of offs. You know, trying to defeat the 9/11 movement. I mean, Cass Sunstein, whom I wrote about in an article entitled Birds of a Feather Subverting the Constitution at Harvard Law, you know, said that he was so concerned about the 9/11 truth movement and its conspiracy theories that he proposed that the truth movement should be infiltrated to be destroyed from the inside out, which means that he's opposing a conspiracy theory by proposing a conspiracy of his own. I mean, it's on that attitude, you know, and it's ridiculous that Alfred should have to bring in a witness whose story about his foreknowledge of these events had been entailed a description that corresponded to the official account, where the Vancouver hearings itself had been devoted to taking it apart piece by piece and demonstrating it was completely untenable. So the situation is quite
difficult. Well, that's been hard for your committee, I guess, to get through all of that and the kind of debates that have been going back between you and Alfred and different people in the group. And I'm pleased to hear you're still trying to carry forward in some way and producing this e-book. I don't know what...
have a complete audio record of the hearings. It's a high-quality audio, okay?
Oh.
We're going to have a audio of the recordings and possibly even a, you know, a video record that's not of as high quality, but, you know, we're gonna come through this just fine. And what we're actually defeating an array of forces allied against us. I mean, it's taken multiple forms, including, you know, that Richard Gage even approached the 9/11 Vancouver group and, from the reports I've heard, discouraged them from supporting us. Now, that's Richard Gage. I find that completely outrageous.
I heard the same thing also.
Even as long ago, Christopher, as when I held the Madison conference, I invited Stephen Jones and Kevin Ryan to speak. Not only did they not speak, Kevin Ryan never even replied, Stephen Jones declined, but they ran a blackball operation, and there were two or three participants I had representing, you know, more or less their point of view, whom they discouraged from coming, and I wound up with a very small group. But it was, you know, substantial compared to what Barbara had to report about the Vancouver and the Toronto hearings. I mean, those who claim that we had a small turnout, and I would agree, would be astonished to learn that the turnout at Toronto was similarly small, except it wasn't so obvious because they were in a much smaller room. And we were in a theater that had 450 people.
Yeah. Yeah, that was very interesting that they ran it in that way to block out so many people. I mean, it seems that we obviously have disinformation theorists in the 9/11 truth movement. Like, one thing that strikes me about the Toronto hearing is no one brings out there the complicity of the media. Because in my view now, when I look back at all the media footage of that day, you can just see all the way along that these people are, they're cons. They're pretending they've seen something they haven't seen. And you see this all the way through that day's events. And that's what it strikes me the Toronto conference doesn't bring out at all, the complicity of the media. Whereas I think the media was involved from the very get-go. They had all their witnesses scripted and what they were to report and so on. So I think that was actually
the fifth subject that we were going to cover at the Vancouver hearings, and the final session was devoted to the role of the media. Mm-hmm. You know, there really wasn't a lot said about it specifically. The most interesting part of that final session was that Webster Tarpley, to my astonishment, denounced all of the speakers who had presented evidence of the complicity of Israel and the Mossad, implying that Israel and the Mossad had nothing to do with it. I was simply dumbfounded by that, to speak the truth here. I mean, Barbara and I had a minor conflict earlier on Sunday over her claim that some sort of plane actually did hit the Pentagon, where I'm rather convinced that's not the case. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, even willing to have her come back on the show to go over this in great detail. But Webster's really emotional, intemperate outburst and condemnation of, I mean, you're talking about, you know, Kevin Barrett and Greg Felton and Joshua Blakeney, all of whom have done exceptional work in this area, was to me dumbfounding. Really, I was astonished. So that was extremely revealing that Webster is not willing to go there. He also mentioned, he said, if we wanted to get after, you know, 9/11 perps, he mentioned four names of people no one has ever heard of. You know, I thought that was also very, very strange.
Yeah.
So that, you know, real glad we're going to have an audio recording, and it looks like we are, that everyone's going to be in the position to listen to it all, because it's fascinating.
Yeah.
It's something you can listen to in your car. Like, you know, we'll put it out on a CD.
Okay, so you're going to move ahead with this other option and try to produce it as an e-book. And I don't know how well this is going to go to give that e-book to different members of Parliament, because I know here in Canada, you know, I'm on the A&E Blueprint for Truth documentary, you know, that where they're in Canada, they're trying to get an MPP in Canada who's willing to take that documentary before the Canadian Parliament, okay? But they can't find anyone. Because there's no MPP who's willing to do it, because they all know that their government is complicit in the whole thing. Like, they have to be.
Well, Christopher, I'm a former Marine Corps officer. You can't fight a battle if you don't have weapons and ammunition. What we're doing is putting together weapons and ammunition in the form of these documented submissions that bring indictments. I mean, mine are very specific. They're actually a right on veterans today. 9/11, Jack Hughes, Zelikow, Rumsfeld, Cheney, Bush, O'Brien. Anyone can go to Veterans Today, Jim Fetzer, and start scrolling through my last half a dozen or more, you know, my last 10 probably, articles there. They're all about 9/11. And I say, if you wanted to get a short course on 9/11, just go to Veterans Today and read those articles, and you're going to be there. You're going to be current. You're going to be right at the cutting edge.
Yeah. But it's like these people own the CIA and the FBI and the Homeland Security. Like, all these people are complicit in these things. And that complicity is so massive. Like, I don't believe that there's a senator or representative in the House of Independence there that doesn't believe 9/11 was an inside job. I don't believe it. I think they all know. That they were confirmed to know when Bush came out shortly afterwards and said, and no one here is allowed to disagree with, you know, our conspiracy theory. And so they all shut up, and they've just maintained that, and they're all controlled by Israeli money through the corporations and such.
Go to these articles on Veterans Today that I've just published, because there's a great exposure here of Israeli meddling in U.S. foreign policy and attempts to induce the United States to attack Iran, and it's all a sham, it's all phony, it's all Benjamin Netanyahu trying to spill American blood and American money to benefit Israel. And I think the American people, frankly, Christopher, are fed up with it. I think it would be very difficult for anyone to understand what's been going on, where Benjamin Netanyahu has actually been attempting to precipitate World War III, to understand these events and not have complete contempt for him and his allies in the American government and for the whole Zionist movement worldwide.
Yeah, it's really quite terrible. It's so sad to see the Iranian spoke most eloquently about tapping, like, controlling the Zionists, and he was saying it's not Israel, it's the Zionists, it's these fanatical Zionists who are precipitating this upon the world.
And of course, everyone has to remember that not all Jews are Zionists, and not all Zionists are Jews. In fact, some of the most fervent Zionists are extreme evangelical Christians who want there to be a war in the Middle East, because they believe that that's going to precipitate the second coming of Christ. I mean, this is a theology that I find quite bizarre, but it's fervently held by a fairly significant number of evangelical Christians who are therefore fervent Zionists, even though, you know, they're Christians, but they're Zionists. So you got the Christian Zionists as well as the Jewish Zionists, and then you got the political Zionists, and there's a right-wing segment of the Republican Party that is very fervently committed to Israel.
Yeah. Yeah, but both parties are very committed. My goodness. I just don't know. It's like, it often impresses me. I go out and I see the 9/11 truthers out on the street giving out DVDs and trying to wake people up. And then you find out, like, why aren't the police out here? Like, what happened to the RCMP? Like, they didn't investigate the murder of 24 Canadians in 9/11. They sidestepped the issue. And the CSIS, like the Canadian military intelligence, they're completely, they know what was done on 9/11. All these people do. That's my impression of it now. It's like Harper, our our prime minister in Canada. He just drove to, or went to New York to receive an award from Henry Kissinger at the Freedom of Religious Conscience or something like that. It's just terrible. It is like these people have completely taken over the Canadian government like they have in the States. And I imagine it's like that around most of the European countries.
Yeah, I think that there are, you know, Israeli tentacles all around the world. And, of course, the Mossad may be the most proficient intelligence operation in the world and specializes in false flag attacks. You can go all the way back to 1946 when the King David Hotel was blown up by a group of Jewish urban terrorists who were dressed as Arabs to try to blame it on the Arabs. You got the attack on the USS Liberty in 1967 when Israeli jets torpedoed and strafed an American spy ship that was monitoring the events of the Six-Day War. And apparently in an effort to blame it on Egypt to bring the United States in on the side of Israel, where Lyndon Johnson, to my utter dismay, actually called back the American fighter aircraft that were going to the defense of Liberty. But once the Jewish pilot saw that the American fighters were coming, they turned tail and headed back to Israel. But it was completely disgraceful. I gave presentations about 9/11 in Buenos Aires in 2008 and 2009 and learned about false flag attacks that have been perpetrated by the Mossad in that country.
In Buenos Aires.
They blew up the Israeli embassy in 1992, but it didn't kill enough people. So in 1994, they turned to their Jewish community center to kill even more. This was in retaliation for, and blamed it on Iran. This is in retaliation for Argentina having engaged in cooperation with the Iranians in the development of their peaceful nuclear energy project. And of course, I mentioned 9/11. I mean, you know, that's truly catastrophic. These guys pull these offs all over the world all the time. And of course, one of the great benefits from having a war on terror rather than a cold war with the Soviet Union, Christopher, is that the Soviet Union had very well-defined geographical boundaries. You could always determine if an action was taken, whether it was by the Soviets or not by the Soviets. But with shadowy terrorist organizations, you can perform a bombing anywhere you want, such as the Bali bombing, and blame it on the terrorists, blame it on Iranians, blame it on Al-Qaeda. And who's in the position to show that that's all wrong, even when it's contrived and done by Blackwater or the CIA or the Mossad?
Yeah, it's terrible. Now we see this new fellow from the Washington branch of some organization who's come out and saying that they need a false flag in order to start the war against Iran. Did you see that?
Well, this is stunning. Here's an Israeli lobbyist who's saying that it's just fine to pull a false flag attack if that's what's necessary to get the world to attack Iran. But you know, and Kevin Barrett has a wonderful article about that. So you can also go to Veterans Today, Kevin Barrett, and see his articles. And Joshua Blakeney, who's now the press correspondent, the Canadian press correspondent for Press TV, also has articles there. But you know what's shocking is that this is so ignorant of history or dismissive, because Iran has not attacked any other country for more than 300 years. Iran has disavowed the use of nuclear weapons. Iran has signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Iran has allowed inspectors. Israel, on the other hand, has 200 to 600 or more of these little beauties. Israel has not signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Israel does not allow inspectors. I mean, there's a problem in the Middle East, but it isn't Iran. The problem is Israel, and it's been so provocative. I think many know of the Samson option, where if Israel thinks it's going to go down, that it has stash nuclear weapons in the capitals of practically all the major cities of the world by using diplomatic pouches, which aren't subject to inspection to do it. and that, you know, Israel is trying to perform a form of nuclear blackmail on other nations. It does seem to me at this point in time that Obama has been standing up to Netanyahu, and for that I'm very pleased. And, of course, he does try to perpetrate the mythology of Osama bin Laden as having had anything to do with 9/11. I mean, we know that when first asked about this, Osama denied having had anything to do with it. He pointed out that it was contrary to the tenets of the Koran to murder innocent women and children, that there was a government within the government of the United States that wanted to blame this on Muslims.
Yeah.
Where, remarkably enough, Bill Clinton, a former president of the United States, said the same thing, that there's a government within the government of the United States and that he did not control it. Osama actually died on or about 15 November 2001. He was buried in an unmarked grave in Afghanistan in accordance with Muslim traditions. There were local obituaries about it. Even Fox News reported it in February and March of 2002. But, of course, it was too convenient to have this boogeyman, so we've had all these phony audio tapes and videotapes and so forth. Scholars has published about it in press releases. If you go to 911scholars.org, check out our press releases, you'll see some about the fake Obama, Osama bin Laden tapes and all that. And, of course, David Ray Griffin has even written a book about it entitled Osama bin Laden Dead or Alive, bringing together all the evidence that he died in 2001. Even our own FBI has admitted that it had, that Osama bin Laden was not accused of being involved in 9/11 because it had no hard evidence that he had anything to do with 9/11.
Yeah,
and where
I mean, we know he didn't. We know now he didn't because we see now how it was done, and how they used the media and how they used those corporations, and we can see how it was done now. I mean, there's no reason to blame Osama any longer.
You're exactly right, Chris. Not only that, but this phony raid in Pakistan was contrived to resolve political problems Obama was confronting here at home. His birth certificate, which is a fraudulent document, I mean, I had an expert on. We went over the birth certificate for 2 hours, and it has all kinds of indications of fakery. Was on the front page. He was being criticized for keeping Guantanamo open and also for having troops stationed in Pakistan. So when this raid took place, they claimed that it had been initiated by a tip from Guantanamo, which thereby was supposed to justify keeping that prison open, that they used troops stationed in Pakistan, which of course then justifies having troops in Pakistan. And of course it swept the whole question about his birth certificate off the front page. And it was he had this phony photograph of the president, the vice president, the secretary of state staring intensely at a big screen, supposedly watching the event as it went down, except that Leon Panetta, who was the director of the CIA at the time, blew that out of the water, observing that the first 20 or 25 minutes there was no coverage, and these ops only take place in about 5 minutes. So now you got this book by the guy who claims to have been the SEAL who actually shot Osama, where the whole thing is phony and contrived, but you read the fine print, as the guy didn't look like Osama, so they shot somebody. Of course, they had to get rid of the body, so they claim they dumped it in the ocean in accordance with Islamic tradition, but that's not an Islamic tradition because it's disrespectful to the body, which can be eaten by fish and sharks and crustaceans.
And then didn't the Marines all get killed who had been involved in it?
That's right.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. We sure have a terrible country. Hey, doesn't it make you sad? It makes me so sad just seeing all this tragedy in the world. And it's all so unnecessary, you know? I mean, America could have been a great country and inspired people around the world. And instead, look what it's become. It's become this fascist state. It's terrible.
I think the turning point, Christopher, was 1963 and the assassination of JFK. I mean, he was going to shatter the CIA into 1,000 pieces.
Yeah.
He was going to cut the oil depletion allowance. He was going to abolish the Fed. He was pulling our troops out of Vietnam. I mean, the man was a visionary. He was having back-channel communications with Nikita Khrushchev because neither of them could trust their military, which were extreme right-wing hawks, including on the U.S. side General Curtis LeMay, who wanted to have a nuclear war with the Soviet Union and claimed that we would kill more of them than we'd kill of us so that we would win it, which caused JFK to get up and leave from the meeting and tell his aide, and we call ourselves the human race. You know, I mean, this is so disgusting.
It is.
He was willing
terrible.
To take 10 million Americans if he could kill 20 million Russians, Soviets.
I had one question about JFK. Have you ever seen that the image of the driver turning around and shooting him in the face?
Well, he wasn't shot in the face, so you know the driver.
Well, I'm not sure it was the face actually, but
Christopher. This is a contentious issue. William Greer, the driver, actually pulled the limousine to the left and to a halt to make sure JFK would be killed.
Uh-huh.
During the stop, which was 3 or 4 seconds, he was shot twice, and back of the head, he fell forward. Jackie eased him up and was looking him right in the face when he was hit in the right temple by a frangible or exploding bullet that blew his brains out the left back of his head to the left rear with such force that the motorcycle that Bobby Hargis riding in that location when hit with the debris, thought he himself had been shot. Now, I organized a research group consisting of the best qualified individuals to ever study the case, a world authority on the human brain who is also an expert on wound ballistics, a PhD in physics who was also an MD and board certified in radiation oncology, which meant he was an expert on the interpretation of X-rays, a physician who was actually present in trauma room 1 when JFK was treated and then was responsible 2 days later for looking after his alleged assassin in trauma room number 2, another PhD in physics who was an expert in electromagnetism, the properties of light, the physics of moving objects, and a legendary photo and film analyst. And what we discovered, Christopher, is that the blowout to the back of the head was patched in the official X-rays, none of which actually are original X-rays. So David Mantic has gone into, PhD MG has gone in there repeatedly. But most importantly, in relation to your question, if Greer, who was to the left front, had shot JFK, who was on the right back, then his brains would have been blown out to the right rear. They were actually blown out to the left rear. So ballistics does not substantiate what many people think they see in some versions of the film, which would be Greer turning back to shoot him. But the ballistics and the medical evidence does not substantiate it. So I can only tell you, I addressed this. I actually produced a 4.5-hour documentary entitled JFK, The Assassination, The Cover-Up, and Beyond, in which I discussed this in detail, the evidence for and against. And I can only tell you that it cannot have happened. It cannot have happened because his brains would have been blown out to the right rear, not to the left. And by the way, that was with a .45. As a Marine Corps officer, I qualified with a .45 4 years in a row. That's quite a powerful bullet. It would have, you know, made a huge mess. But JFK did not have any damage to his face. Even as Jackie testified to the Warren Commission, from the front, he looked just fine. But at the back of the head, she had a terrible time trying to hold the back of his skull together. In fact, when she climbs out onto the back trunk, she's going after a big chunk of Jack's skull and brains, not to get away from the alleged shooter, as some have maintained. And in fact, Clint Hill, who was a Secret Service agent who rushes forward to assist Jackie, he was her personal agent, has for nearly 50 years given exactly the same recording in formal written documents and oral presentations and other that he got on the back of the limo, pushed Jackie down, lay across both their bodies, peered down into this fist-sized gaping hole in the back of JFK's head, turned to his colleagues and gave them a thumbs down, all before they got to the triple underpass.
Oh.
Now, it's a Zapruder film, you see him get on the back of the film, and that's it. And the reason is, they had to remove the limo stop because it was such a glaring indication of Secret Service complicity, of which there are you know, more than a dozen additional indications. And when they did that, there just wasn't any time for Clint Hill to perform those feats, even though even Roy Kellerman, who was in charge of the presidential limo and was sitting in the passenger seat beside William Greer, told the Warren Commission they'd looked back and he'd seen Clint Hill lying across the back of the trunk. He was actually lying across the back seat, but from his perspective, it looked like he was lying across the back of the trunk, all before reaching the triple underpass. This is one of many proofs we have that the video was altered. I mean, there's a massive evidence about this. We know when it was done, where it was done, what was done. And if anyone wants an introduction to that, go to Veterans Today, Jim Fetzer. Look for the article entitled JFK, Who's Telling the Truth, Clint Hill or the Zapruder Film?
So you really, in a way, you trace all our current difficulties back to that 1963, I guess it was, eh?
This was the ultimate assertion of power by these special interests over the government of the United States, because every president since JFK, except for Lyndon, but even Lyndon worried about it, because Lyndon was deeply involved. Lyndon was complicit in the assassination of JFK. He'd actually forced himself on the ticket in 1960 after Jack had already actually extended the nomination to Stuart Symington of Missouri. Bobby came to Lyndon to make a pro forma gesture, which he expected Lyndon would decline, since as the majority leader, he wielded a great deal of genuine political power. And the vice presidency was widely then regarded as not worth a picture of warm spit, sometimes is the word, but it was a more colorful term that was used by the person who made the assertion. And what Lyndon did was to tell Bobby that if he weren't on the ticket, that he'd expose that Jack had had dalliances with a beautiful German woman who turned out, a beautiful woman who turned out to be an East German spy, that he also had Addison disease and therefore wasn't expected to live a long life, and that if he weren't on the ticket, since he'd still be majority leader, he said that he'd bottle up any legislation sent down by the White House, which forced Bobby and Jack to reverse the invitation of Simon and take him on the ticket. He told supporters were told, came to the suite of Lyndon Johnson upset that he was going to run with Jack, which they regarded as a form of betrayal. Bobby Baker took him in the other room and explained the reason for doing it. Namely, they put Lyndon in the position where he'd accede to the presidency should anything happen to JFK. Lyndon Johnson would later say he studied American political history and he knew that one out of four presidents hadn't survived their term in office and that he was a gambling man, but Lyndon Johnson was anything but a gambling man. If you want to know, the two excellent books about all of this are by James Douglas, entitled JFK and the Unspeakable, who shows how he upset all the most powerful special interest groups in the country with his policies and how hostile they were toward JFK. And the other is entitled LBJ, Mastermind of JFK's Assassination by Phil Nelson, which explains what they did about it.
Okay, I notice we're coming down to the end of our time. Jim, I don't know if there's anything you wanted to remind the listeners of or any thoughts you wanted to leave on. Or you have a radio show. It's at Blogspot. Is it blogspot.com?
Radiofetzer.blogspot.com. Blogspot.com is for a whole host of different blogs, but my radio archives are at radiofetzer.blogspot.com. I also have a personal blog at jamesfetzer.blogspot.com. Of course, I founded Scholars for 9/11 Truth in December of 2005, and you can find the website for scholars at 911scholars.org. I also manage the Scholars Forum at 911scholars.ning, ning.com. I have an assassinationscience.com website that deals with all of these issues. That was actually my first and original website. And then there's an online journal for advanced study of the death of JFK that I co-edit with John P. Costella, who is a PhD in physics with a specialty in electromagnetism, who did so much in order to prove that, you know, proving that based upon internal evidence that the Zapruder film was a fake. And that's at assassinationresearch.com. I might mention Costella has a visual tutorial. What John did was to go through the best of them best available version and make it better by removing pincushion and aspect ratio distortion. And since the NPIC version is missing frames and has frames in the wrong order, he restored those frames and put them in the right order. So there is the best available version of the Zapruder film in both individual frames and in a stabilized film version available at assassinationscience.com. Just go down and scroll down.
Okay.
You'll find his tutorial there, but you'll also find his new Zapruder film frames and the stabilized version, which is all available to the public for free. The government has tried to contrive to keep research on the Zapruder film in the hands of a private company that then charges exorbitant fees for research to keep it bottled up, which has been carried on by the Sixth Floor Museum, which I'm sorry to say is another aspect of a cover-up operation. I think we know this, you know, quite well. For example, my books, they won't carry the three books I edited, bringing together experts on different aspects of the assassination. Assassination Science, which was published in 1998, Murder in Dealey Plaza 2000, and The Great Zapruder Film Hoax in 2003, which even Vincent Bugliosi, the famous prosecutor from Los Angeles, who wrote this monster book attempting to defend the Warren Commission, entitled, History, Recapturing History, or History Reclaimed, said, with the only three exclusively scientific books ever published on the assassination, where the Sixth Floor Museum justified it's not carrying those books on the grounds that it didn't meet the research standards of the Sixth Floor Museum, which is, of course, a manifest absurdity.
Thanks, Jim, very much for being on again today. I really appreciate your efforts, and you're my hero. You're out there. I don't know how you face all that you do in your life. I really don't get it. I'm proud that you do, though, and you have many of us who thank you for what you've done in your life to pursue these things.
I'm very grateful to you for having me on again, Christopher. And I would mention, regarding current developments in the Middle East, I have appeared repeatedly on Press TV. So another way to see interviews with me on international television is to do a search on Press TV, James Fetzer. They refer to me as James Fetzer.
Okay.
And you can find it. So I'll warn you, if you just do a search on Jim Fetzer on Google, that they have tried to disrupt. There are hundreds of my presentations, but if you now go a couple pages, you'll see it's disrupted by several pages of nothing before it begins again. It's part and parcel of an ongoing disinfo op to prevent the public from gaining access to my work.
And we'll keep in touch, and I'd like to thank BBS Radio for hosting the Zero Point Show. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time. Thank you all.
Thank you both.